For decades, one notable performance of the court's proceedings has been Nina Totenberg's so-called dirty reads on NPR. Audio of oral arguments is only released on Fridays, with rare exceptions, so Nina has become perhaps the most admired practitioner of the art of on-air Supreme Court oral interpretation. Here she reads from the transcript of a case last year about religious rights for inmates, specifically whether Muslim prisoners may wear half-inch beards in Arkansas prisons.
Justice Breyer, then do you think this might be what Congress was trying to prevent when it said that exaggerated fears often allowed prison officials to stop prisoners from exercising their religious rights? Answer, just because we haven't found the example doesn't mean they aren't there. Justice Alito, exasperated, then why can't the prison just give the inmate a comb and tell him to comb out his beard? And if there's a tiny revolver hidden in his half-inch beard, it will fall out.
The dirty read. You're not crazy about that term.
No, I'm not. I think I was guilty of the dirty read when I was young in radio. The dirty read suggests you're taking neutral terms, but with your inflection, you're making them sound nefarious. And I don't ever do that anymore. What I do, because I have no contemporaneous tape of the oral arguments, and I do cover them, is try my best to bring the listener into the courtroom through my voice, picking the pithiest parts of the argument, and as best as I can, acting them out as I heard them. And so that's not a dirty read. That's an accurate read.
Of course, the reason the dirty read even exists is because the justices forbid filming of any kind during oral arguments or on decision days. And some reporters even agree.
Because it's very loosey-goosey and brutal sometimes, rough and tumble up there. And if there were cameras, some people definitely would pull their punches and oral argument would not be what it is. But the most important thing, I think, is that if these nine people had their faces on TV all the time, they would have to have an enormous security apparatus to protect them all the time that doesn't exist today. And they live in an ivory tower enough. It's good that I can see Elena Kagan squeezing a melon at the Safeway or the Whole Foods. It's good that some of these folks drive themselves. You know, when they go to a big event, they're driven, they're protected, but they lead normal lives. And if they didn't, that ivory tower would become farther up in the sky and even more remote. And I don't think that would be good for the country.
Slate's Dahlia Lithwick is sympathetic to the privacy argument, but still comes down on the side of increased transparency.
The arguments I have no patience for are the arguments that say that it's too complicated for lay people to understand, and if they saw it, they just get all confused and weird. When you have an institution that 90% of what it does is private, what it does in public needs to be seen by the public.
But she concedes the public won't be seeing them courtside anytime soon.
I think those of us who watch for signs that the justices are going to open up to more technology, they're going to allow more bloggers to be credentialed, they're going to allow cameras in there, we always think, let's look at the younger ones. Let's look at Justice Kagan and Sotomayor. Let's look at John Roberts. He has young kids. Maybe he's going to be open to it. And inexorably, what happens is they say at their confirmation hearings, you know, I'm open to the possibility of cameras in there. I understand people need to see. And within 6 months on the bench, they're like, nope, never going to happen. So there it is. I think it's not about youth. It's about privacy.
But why take our word for it? The justices have spoken many times over the years explaining their views. And there's little doubt that the next nominee will be asked to weigh in as well. So we thought we'd let them speak for themselves. Here are Justices Kennedy, Kagan, Breyer, Sotomayor, Thomas, Ginsburg, former Justice Souter, and the late Justice Scalia on the issue of cameras in the court in their own words, more or less.
Television in court. I was for it when I first joined the court and switched and remained on that side of it. I do not believe the purpose would be to educate the American people.
It will alter the way in which we hear our cases, the way in which we talk to counsel, the way in which we use that precious power. Please don't introduce into the dynamic the temptation, the insidious temptation to think that one of my colleagues is trying to get a soundbite for the television. We don't want that. Please, Senator, we don't want that. Please don't introduce the temptation, the insidious temptation.
Television in the court.
The way in which we use that precious, precious hour.
Television in the court.
We'll have to talk together.
We don't want that.
Television in the court.
I think it would be a terrific thing.
Please don't introduce the insidious temptation. Trying to get a soundbite for the television.
Could you argue the opposite position?
I could make a lot of points about educating the public.
If the American people watched our proceeding gavel to gavel, they would never again ask, Jessica Lee, why do you have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court?
When you see what happens, it's an inspiring sight. All nine justices, so prepared, so smart, so thorough, really seeing government at work.
A million people could have seen that oral argument. That would be wonderful.
I have had positive experiences with cameras.
It seems somewhat perverse to exclude the television.
I don't see any problem with having proceedings televised.
So it sounds like you all changed your minds.
The day you see a camera coming into our courtroom, it's going to roll over my dead body.
Regular appearances on TV would mean significant changes in the way my colleagues could conduct their lives. My anonymity is already gone.
Most of the American people would see 15-second takeouts, and those takeouts would not be characteristic of what we do. They would be uncharacteristic.
Yeah, now what we see is an article in a newspaper that's out of context.
That's fine. People read that and they say, well, it's an article in a newspaper. But somehow when you see it live, an excerpt live, it has a much greater impact.
Television in the court.
Over my dead body.
Good for the public.
Television in the court.
That would be wonderful.
We don't want that.
Television in the court.
My anonymity is already gone.
It means I'd have to get my hair done more often, Senator Spector.
Oh. Let me commend you on that last comment.
One last thing, and that is the credits. Will you read them?
Oh, yeah. I've got them. You want a genuinely dirty read, or do you want a clean read?
I want a genuinely dirty read.
It doesn't give me a lot to work with.
I'll say.
Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Bob, that's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Dasha Lisitsi. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, Brooke. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Bob, and I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.